prepare yourself for the terror. The prison of madness, where few enter and none return.
Welcome to Unsung Horrors. With Lance. And Erica.
Leave all your sanity behind. It can't help you now.
Welcome to another episode of Unsung Horrors, the podcast where we discuss underseen horror films, specifically those with fewer than 1,000 views on Letterboxd. I'm Lance.
And I'm Erica.
And before we jump into this episode's film, The Man Who Thought Life, spring break was a few weeks ago for a lot of people.
Spring break!
And for Austin, that means South by Southwest. I attended it again this year. I've been a screener for the last 6 years. I've mentioned it on the podcast, and I've been attending it for the last 6 years. It's now called Film and TV. They threw in and TV Festival.
Oh, God.
Yeah, there was a lot of premieres for television series.
All right.
Like Swarm, Donald Glover Swarm. But yeah, I thought I'd talk about a couple of movies that I watched.
Please do.
Yeah, it wasn't a bad year. So the few screeners I watched, you know, before the festival, I do narrative features. The few that I rated highly, you know, for to actually maybe be programmed into the festival, they made it.
That's good.
And this is completely unheard of, but 9 of the screeners I watched, mm-hmm. or 9 of the 80 or so screeners I watched, made it into the festival. Usually it's like 1 or 2 per year. Every time I've, you know, the last 6 years or so I've done it, but 9? It's like, holy
wow.
shit.
Okay.
A lot of them I probably wouldn't have programmed, but I'll talk about a few though. So a few of the screeners that I've watched that made it in that I really enjoyed, I didn't watch them during the festival, but there was one called Upon Entry, which was about this couple from Venezuela, I think it was, and they're immigrating to the U.S. to kind of start a new life. And then they're hounded. They land in New York and they're hounded by these kind of border agents, officers. Mm-hmm. And they learn stuff about each other's past that they never told each other. It's like 74 minutes, really tight, really, really well done movie. I recommend that one definitely. Like, that was the highest rated screener I actually watched. And then one called Brooklyn 4-5, which is coming to Shudder. I guess it's called Brooklyn 45. It takes place in 1945. It's directed by that Ted Gagan. Is that how you say his name? He did We Are Still Here with Barbara Crampton.
Okay.
That was a lot of fun. I think the Shudder crowd's going to eat it up. It's like a single location. Some good gory effects. It has that Larry Fessenden. What's his name? Larry
Fessenden?
Fessenden in it. Yeah.
Okay.
And then there was a movie I watched called Talk to Me. It was a screener. For me, I noted it was very middle of the road. I noted it would be a banger of a midnighter, which is kind of the genre films for South by Southwest. They play later in the day. They're usually the horror genre. Yeah, I thought it'd be a great midnighter, and it was. People loved it. Like, everybody that I saw on Letterboxd, and you know, I would check some of the reviews. They loved this movie. Mm. I called it like a reimagined Flatliners. It's about like these kids, it's an Australian horror, and it's about these young kids that conjure up the dead, and they have these seances to purposely possess each other. It's kind of like a high that they get.
Okay.
It's okay, but people seem to love it. Apparently A24 picked it up.
Oh, well, there it is.
So I'm sure it's going to get a release pretty quick. But yeah, along with some of these like genre films that popped up south and changing it from film to TV, South by Southwest kind of felt a little more, I'm not going to say like it feels like Fantastic Fest, but along with adding some TV series stuff, which Fantastic Fest does, South by Southwest this year did some special secret screeners, which is very odd. Usually everything's programmed beforehand and announced, but they did 2 special secret screeners, and I got into both. I wasn't sure what they were. They were kind of leaked and released before, so people kind of knew like a day or two before during the festival. John Wick Chapter 4.
Okay.
Which was fine. You know, Keanu was there.
Everybody loves that movie. They're like 4.5. And I can't. It's almost 3 hours. And I just,
exactly.
I don't have any interest in that. I've heard the last hour is a banger. And I was like, well, why can't it be the last hour and then 30 minutes before that?
Right. It could definitely be trimmed. You feel the runtime.
Okay.
And that's the thing with John Wick. I love the first two. Mm-hmm. I became completely fatigued with chapter three,
okay,
Parabellum or whatever it was called, but they progressively get longer and longer. Like the first one's like an hour 40, then it's 2 hours and it's over 2 hours. And this one is just under 3 hours long. And I'm just like, holy shit, you feel the runtime.
Yeah.
I did like it. It's kind of like a love letter. He pulls a lot of inspirations from, like, I'm sure you've heard The Warriors. There's a lot of that. Once Upon a Time in the West. There's a lot of Sergio Leone stuff. Like, there's the director and the writer, they seem to have a lot of fun with this. They wear a lot of their influences on their sleeve. And when they were being interviewed and they did a Q&A, you could tell they were really, it was the most fun they've had of all of them.
Okay.
So I enjoyed this one way more than three, but you do feel the runtime. Then the closing night film, which was also a special screening, which is always really odd to me for South by Southwest. Usually that's announced, mm-hmm, but it's Air by Ben Affleck.
Okay. Yeah. Is that the Nike Michael Jordan thing?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I saw that the subtitle was removed, but it was called Air, Courting a Legend, but that's gone. It's just called Air now.
Okay.
But yeah, it's directed by Ben Affleck, stars Ben Affleck, Matt Damon, Jason Bateman, Viola Davis. Great cast. It's 2 hours long and it doesn't feel like 2 hours at all.
Yeah.
I thought it was awesome.
Okay.
Great editing, performances. I was never bored, even though the subject could be boring for some. But yeah, it's Nike trying to sign rookie Michael Jordan, who was set on signing a contract with Adidas on this partnership that essentially created sneaker culture as we know it today. This is an Amazon Studios, so I think it's getting a theatrical release in mid-March, but it should be hitting Amazon, I think, pretty quick.
It is mid-March. It's mid-April. Oh, okay.
But yeah, I recommend that. I think, yeah, Ben Affleck's back, baby. Okay. No Batfleck.
Okay.
And then I'm just going to hit on a few other. The opening night movie, the big premiere, was Dungeons & Dragons. Honor Among Thieves. This is directed by John Francis Daly and Jonathan Goldstein. They directed Game Night and The New Vacation with Ed Helms. Game Night, I think that's with Jason Bateman. And,
okay, I saw that.
Yeah. And John Francis Daly, he's a recognizable guy. He played the lead Sam in the Freaks and Geeks series.
Okay, yeah.
I like him. I like, you know, this movie was just, it was fun. It was okay. I was surprised I enjoyed it as much as I did.
Sure.
But yeah, Chris Pine's in it, Michelle Rodriguez, Hugh Grant, Bradley Cooper pops up in a really funny cameo.
Okay.
Spoilers. Yeah, that's already released, I think, or it's released, I know, overseas. But and then Evil Dead Rise, which the new Evil Dead movie,
okay,
directed by Lee Cronin. Sam Raimi, Bruce Campbell produced, they were there. Robert Tappert, who produced the originals. It stars Lily Sullivan and Alyssa Sutherland, and they're both great in it. They lead the whole movie. They're the reason to watch it because I think the story's really lazy. The gore's there. The practical effects looks great. People seem to love this and enjoy it, which I'm happy. I mean, the audience was so into it. I was like, okay. The guy next to me, he was one of those guys, and I respect everybody. You react however you want when watching a movie. In a theater, I think there should be some etiquette, but every time something scary would happen, and you know it's a buildup, he was like, oh no, don't do it, oh no. Like, he kept doing that, and it kind of interfered with my viewing experience.
Yeah.
I don't think I would have, like, loved it if he wasn't there, but it was an odd audience.
Well, that having someone like that next to you can ruin something, but I don't think it like you said, I don't think it necessarily affects your opinion of the movie. Like, John and I just went to go see Inherent Vice, and there, two seats over from me, was a guy who I'm guessing he's seen this movie multiple times because he was laughing at jokes before they came on.
Oh, yeah.
But he was also laughing at things that weren't funny at all. And I'm not saying that because I have a different sense of humor. I'm saying that because these were legit things that, like, two cars pulled up in a parking lot and he would laugh. I'm like, what the fuck is the matter with you? And so, like, it didn't, like, I recognize, like, I had a lot of fun with the movie, but I am like, okay, when I rewatch that, I'm going to watch that at home.
Yeah.
So I don't have to worry about having a guy like that again.
Yeah. This guy was making comments too, like, calling characters, oh, you stupid bitch, don't do that, you know? And I was just like, and
ew.
It's a pact. It was at Paramount. It was a premiere. If I could, I would have move seats.
Right.
But I couldn't go anywhere.
Right.
Yeah. But yeah, I'm glad everybody's loving this movie. Not only was he a strange audience member, but there was a Q&A afterwards with everybody.
Yeah.
It was supposed to, you know, I don't usually like it when they take audience questions.
I don't. Yeah.
But they were, you know, they planned to, they announced it. It was the end of the movie. Everybody came out on stage. The moderator's like, "Hey, we have mics lined up. Start lining up for Q&As." And all of a sudden you hear from one of the balconies, one of the box seats in the Paramount, a guy yell, "This movie fucking sucked," super loud. Everybody on stage, Sam Raimi, Bruce Campbell, everybody's like shocked. And the moderator is staring at this guy who throws his box. There's a video out there.
Yeah. In one of them.
Yeah, that's what he said. I think the person to my right was taking a video. But yeah, it was very, apparently this guy was, I did notice, I looked up, I put two and two together, but during the movie, I could see somebody scrolling. I was in the balcony and I could see somebody scrolling on their phone during the whole movie, on and off. And apparently it was this guy.
Yeah.
I think he was drunk. I think he was getting kicked out at that moment and he just like threw a fit. And he started walking up the wrong way, going up to a no exit, like to the top of the balcony. And he was flipping the double bird to the cast and crew. And Bruce Campbell was like, "Get the fuck out of here, you fucking asshole." And it was very awkward. They didn't open up the floor to Q&A. The moderator was completely flustered. He ended the Q&A really quick. Nobody asked Sam Raimi a question. Nobody asked Bruce Campbell a question. It was very awkward. It was terrible.
I heard some rumors online that he was a plant because of like the seat that he had, and that like they were like, "Oh, he's part of like a marketing strategy for them, that maybe like he was supposed to like do something else to get a reaction out of them, but maybe he got drunk beforehand and just didn't do whatever he was supposed to do, right?"
Right.
Or it was just a bad marketing.
Yeah.
You know,
I've read some of those too. And I don't know. To me, it seemed like a legit asshole.
Okay.
Because the way it was handled, like I felt like if there was some sort of marketing, you mean like by the film itself in the studio, I feel like it would have been handled a lot better and maybe they had a plan of action, but the way it was handled afterwards makes me think like this was, it felt real to me, but
okay.
Maybe not.
I mean, you were there, so I would trust you more than like, you know, random internet guy being like, "What is a marketing ploy by blah, blah, blah."
Yeah, I wouldn't get it because like I would have loved to hear Sam Raimi talk about the franchise, and I would have loved to see, you know, get Bruce Campbell thoughts. Like, why would they have been there if they wouldn't be? They didn't say one word except "Get the fuck out of here, you asshole."
Yeah,
but yeah, it was kind of a weird experience. And let me quickly go over some other movies that I liked that I actually watched in the theater. One was called The Artifice Girl. It's directed, written, and starred a guy named Franklin Rich. It was filmed during the pandemic, so it's a very minimal cast, very low budget too, which I love to see. But it was about this man who he creates this AI online presence of this young girl to kind of fish and catch pedophiles, and then he would turn them over to the government and, you know, make these arrests and stuff. And it doesn't give like a specific time period, but you kind of cut to the future, and they start. The government starts building these robot AIs, these little kids, to actually physically go out and catch predators and meet up with them.
Wow. Why didn't they just send Megan Mithrigan?
Yeah, no, that was brought up a lot too, during the Q&A. Like, the guy was like, Franklin Rich, the director, was like, "When Megan came out, I was like, oh, fuck, there goes my whole idea." Like, but it's completely different.
Okay.
But the AI children that they start building, and the actual AI, these entities that they're building, they start kind of developing their own feelings. So it becomes like this question of, do we need to ask consent from these AI children? And it's very thought provoking. Most of the scenes are like, I feel like it's three or four locations, and it's just very well written script. Like, the dude really did his research. How the AI is presented and voiced, it sounds really great. It does jump, you know, from decades and decades and decades. And this was a surprise to me, but the main guy, Franklin Rich, who's in pretty much every scene, at the end of the movie when he's old, he's played by Lance Henriksen, pops up, and I'm like, oh, fuck yeah. I wish he was there, but. The Artifice Girl, I don't think it has distribution, but keep an eye out on that. That's one I recommend. One more I do recommend is Chronicles of a Wandering Saint. This is like a strange film that bends kind of a bunch of genres. It's like horror, fantasy, comedy. Mm-hmm. It's from Argentina by a director who also wrote it named Tomás Gómez Bustillo. And it's about an older woman who wants more recognition in this little village she's living in. So she fakes a miracle to possibly reach sainthood.
Okay.
By this very religious community. Really funny, really well done. Again, it's low budget, but the effects that they do is some of the best I saw during the whole festival. I'll definitely be keeping an eye out on that director to see what he does next. Cause this was his first feature and he had like a few shorts before, but he was really great. And then last, just a few documentaries. I think the documentaries are usually the best of South by Southwest in most cases.
Yeah, I was going to ask. I was like, normally you spend most of your time talking about the documentaries.
And, yeah.
You know, I think one year you were all about Who Let the Dogs Out or whatever that one. I still haven't seen that.
I think it's on Hulu. It's streaming somewhere.
Oh, God damn it. that
was a surprise. We just, my friend Mike and I just went in and Sarah was with us. And we just went in like, I think it was like a midnight or a draft house and we were drunk and we're like, who let the dogs out? Let's go.
Yeah.
And it fucking was like the best of the fest. but a few that I saw, Going Varsity and Mariachi. So I'm from the Rio Grande Valley.
Yeah.
And this takes place in the Rio Grande Valley. So I saw a lot of recognizable high schools and it's about basically high schools along the border towns, Laredo, Edinburgh, McAllen. Sadly, no Harlingen, which is where I was born. Mm. But these high schools have a varsity mariachi band and they follow this one from North Edinburgh and their whole, their drive to get to state. So it's just mariachi bands. This was at Paramount. It's a lot of fun.
Mm.
It was actually very touching. The kids were a lot of fun to watch. They were all there and they did a really funny Q&A. I watched Robert Irwin, A Desert of Pure Feeling. And this was a great artist who started in the 50s. He did a lot of physical, canvas art. And then he moved to building these art installations later in life that basically just worked and played on, trees and the shadow that's cast from the sun at any time of day. He worked on building the Chinati Foundation in Marfa, Texas, which is, gorgeous. But that was a really fun, a little bit too long, but it was a very interesting documentary. And then one of my favorites was Last Stop Larima, which Larima is a small town in Australia. It has it's about this town, Larima. There's about 11 people living there and one of them goes missing. So they're all murder suspects.
Oh.
And it's just like all these twists and turns. This one was a little long too, but it was probably my favorite of the docs that I watched. It's coming to HBO this year,
okay.
But it's Duplass Brothers produced, doc, but there's a lot of twists and turns. And did he go missing? And that, did he just go wander off in the outback in the bush and just die? Was he murdered? Find out. It's a great ending. Crack open a beer because everybody in it is just like fucking drunk when they're being interviewed. Just these like rough Australian guys that are just like, ah, fuck it, I don't know. Just having a good time.
Nice.
But yeah, no, I watched about, with all the screeners, the 9 screeners that I watched before, 25 total films. I watched 15 at the festival. Mm-hmm. If anybody, I have a Letterboxd list. If anybody has any, wants any opinions for any reason, hit me up. See what I watched. South by Southwest. Let's jump into the movie.
Okay.
The Man Who Thought Life from 1969. Such a thought-provoking title from the start.
Yes.
I love it. A lot of what would you do type of situations that we're going to be jumping into.
Yeah.
It's a Danish film. As I mentioned the last episode, it's much more sci-fi than horror, but it's categorized as a horror on pretty much all the sites like Letterboxd, IMDb. So I picked it.
Counts.
Yes. Okay. So the film, it opens with a character named Steinmetz, who is holding a mouse and approaching people on the street in a very animated way, showing them the little mouse in his hands. We later determine that this is the first time Steinmetz has willed a living creature into existence, because Steinmetz has this power to create objects and living things into existence by willpower alone, by simply concentrating on what he wants to create. But organic life that he creates only remains physical for a few hours. So when he is taken into custody for raving like a madman on the street at people asking if they can see his little mouse, he demands to speak to a well-known brain surgeon slash psychiatrist named Max Holtz. Steinmetz believes that Dr. Holtz can operate on his brain to correct or allow him to overcome the issue of these living organic beings from disappearing. And Steinmetz wants to essentially become a god. He wants to create a human being and maintain it. And while Steinmetz explains and displays his power to Dr. Holtz, making a box of cigars appear out of nowhere, Holtz at first accepts to do the surgery, but quickly declines. He doesn't want anything to do with this absurd power or what he believes at first to be like a weird trick of hypnotism or being put in a trance. And he thinks Steinmetz is insane. So Steinmetz is pissed because he's shown Holtz his power and Holtz broke his initial oath. So he starts fucking Holtz over, creating short-lived doppelgangers of Holtz who are going to his job, doing his work, sleeping with his fiance, taking over Holtz's life. So essentially, Steinmetz is making the real Holtz dissolve while consistently creating Holtz, you know, these multiple Holtzes to prepare for and perform the surgery he wants. So as of this recording, The Man Who Thought Life has 243 views on Letterboxd, and you could watch it on YouTube. So the crew, the crew and the cast are very small. And there's not a lot of credits on here. So
it's also kind of difficult to find a lot of the films that a lot of them worked on, or even if you can, with English subtitles. So yeah, I didn't do much homework on this one. So sorry.
Yeah. I kind of started. So I initially picked this because South by Southwest was going on. I was like, yeah, I want a movie where I'm not going to probably be able to spend as much time as I'd like doing a lot of, a lot of information and spiderwebbing into filmographies, but I actually dove into some. So let's start with the director. And I want to apologize beforehand to any like Danish listeners or Hello. Polish. I'm probably going to butcher a lot of these names. I'm a dumb American. So, but the director, Jens Ravind, he only went on to direct three other films after this, which was kind of surprising for me, from 1971 to 1981. One being a TV movie called Waste and Service from 1975. I didn't watch any of these. I couldn't find any, but others are called The Tar Dealer from 1971. These are English translations, so the titles might be a little bit off. The Wolf Hour from 1981. He also directed a 6-episode TV series called The Fisherman in 1977. But Ravind, he was more of an assistant director or second unit, assisting on over a dozen films.
Okay.
Which he started doing at the age of 19 in 1960. Most notably, he was the assistant director on Gertrude in 1964, which was Carl Theodor Dreyer's final film. And Dreyer, you know, directed The Passion of Joan of Arc, Vampire, Day of Wrath. Most of Dreyer's films have received the Criterion treatment, but they're beautiful black and white films. So I think it's kind of obvious that Ravind did pick up a lot of, you know, Dreyer's like artistic, visual framing and stuff like that. I did watch Gertrude. It was about a woman who, you know, whose name's Gertrude, who divorces her husband, who's a politician, because she's found love in a very young pianist. That's how you say it, right?
Pianist.
It's adapted from a play. It's all very staged. Each scene consisting of only a few actors, single locations, but it's beautifully shot, like I said, but it is kind of that Gertrude's kind of groundbreaking for Dreyer and the time because of these multiple long takes, some 10 minutes long. You kind of get that too from The Man Who Thought Life, some of this stuff that Ravind worked on. I did watch a few other films where he was the assistant director. The Only Way from 1970. This was on Tubi, directed by Danish director Bent Christensen. And I really enjoyed this one. It takes place in Denmark during World War II. 400,000 Danes come together to protect a small Jewish community that they have of only about 8,000 Jewish Danes from the invading Nazis that are coming in. It's slow, but I thought it was quite thrilling. It's a cool insight in how Denmark handled the Nazi invasion. One thing that was weird about that movie is everybody spoke English in it, which was, you know, was cool because there's no, you know, at least we can find this on Tubi and people can watch this. But it stars a 19-year-old Jane Seymour as one of the old Jewish family's daughters. And there's some other English actors. So the reason for the language makes sense.
Yeah.
No spoilers on The Only Way, but it has a great final shot.
Okay.
But it's on Tubi. And then I watched a movie that Raven assisted with called The Red Mantle from 1967, also known as Hagbard and Signe, directed by Gabriel Axel. This I watched on Cave of Forgotten Films.
Oh, nice.
And the editor of this movie, Lars Bridesen, he's also the editor of The Man Who Thought Life. But it's this very simple tale of love. There's these three brothers. Their father was murdered by a king. They head out to seek revenge to fight the king's three sons, but they all end up making peace and becoming like buddies. And then one of the murdered father's sons, Hagbard, he falls in love with the king's daughter, but another man loves her and they start conspiring against the brothers. And it turns into this very Romeo and Juliet style love story. I loved it. I gave this one 4 stars on Letterboxd.
I saw that. I was like, whoa.
I think I loved it maybe because I was sneaking these viewings in between, like at home during South by Southwest. So all these shiny new, brand new premiere movies were, I was kind of getting burned out on them. But it's shot in Iceland, gorgeous landscapes. Yet you can see, in this one, you could see a lot the framing that Raven does so well in The Man Who Thought Life, which I think he picked up a lot from Gabriel Axel, the director for The Red Mantle. But yeah, Raven, he also co-wrote The Man Who Wrote Who Thought Life, which was based off of a novel by Valdemar Holst, which is the name of the main character, last name. And he co-wrote a couple of his other films, but he mainly did directing and assistant directing. He's still alive, but his last credits on IMDb that I can find are just all producing credits, the last being this Danish crime thriller called Hannah Wolf from 2004. But yeah, the next crew member is cinematographer, because the shots and the framework in this movie are what push it to another level.
They're gorgeous. Like every shot is framed perfectly. Like it's very symmetrical, which I think is very purposeful in something like this, especially when you're talking about twins and doppelgangers, like having like two equal sides of something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Everything. Yeah. It's beautiful. And it's the cinematographer is a Polish filmmaker named, Witold Leszczynski. I think that's how you say his name. This is actually his first feature length film as cinematographer. He only shot a few other films, but he was mainly a director and writer of films. He directed his own films, but I don't think he was ever cinematographer on those films. But I watched two of his films that he directed. I was completely blown away by them. One of them I gave 5 stars. I rarely give 5 stars, even though I overrate a lot of movies. You know that. But this one is called The Lynette from 1982. It's about modernizing this small potato farming village, you know, draining the marshland to build roads, add electricity. But the lead character's against any changes, including educating his own son, as he feels like his power and his manhood is being taken from him. But he becomes very frustrated as he finds that many of the beliefs and the traditions that he was raised on and taught his own children are just simply not true. But at the whole time, he's fantasizing about this teacher who comes in and is teaching all the kids. So it's just this weird, it sounds kind of boring, but it's so well shot and paced. The performances are perfect. It's funny. It's very thought-provoking. I loved it. The Lynette, I don't know where I watched it. I think it was on YouTube. And then I watched a film that Witold directed called Matthew's Days. This was actually the Polish entry at the Cannes Film Festival in 1968.
Yeah.
And The Man Who Thought Life was actually the Danish entry in 1969 for Cannes Film Festival. But Matthew's Days it's a weird, oddly toned like drama about this man named Matthew or Mateus and his sister Olga. They live together. Matt is a little slow. He's not a very smart man. And it follows him over the course of a few days, how he sees the world, how people react to him. And then he learns his sister has met a man. He gets worried that she will leave. And he kills himself because of it. It's like the stark comedy, but still depressing on how this character who can't control his emotions react to possibly losing, you know, his sister, his caretaker, the only person he's really known. It's only 76 minutes. It's a good watch, but it's kind of a downer.
I just looked up the Lynette on Letterboxd, mm-hmm. and I'm sorry, you did not say anything about this poster being a fucking all-timer.
Oh, yeah.
Hello.
That poster, it looks like Robert Crumb or something. Like the, it's like a drawing.
Yeah.
Of,
no, don't spoil. Everyone look it up on Letterboxd. Okay.
But yeah, no, I was most excited to dive into Leschinski's filmography more than any other person involved because of the framing, the camera work, and The Man Who Thought Life. Mm-hmm. I can't wait to check out his other stuff. He has like a dozen other films or so. Okay, and then the last crew member I want to bring up real quick is the composer, Per Norgo. He mainly did Danish TV series, television work, but he did most of Gabriel Axel's films, who did The Red Mantle that I talked about, which Ravin also assisted for directing. But Gabriel Axel films that I watched that Norgo did the original scores for was one what's pretty well known, Babette's Feast from 1987.
Oh, yeah.
This I thought was the strongest score of the four or so films I watched that Norgo did the score for. Because the score for The Man Who Thought Life is very low key. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of music. It's mainly just silence or dialogue.
Yeah.
There is a weird moment when Steinmetz wills the cigar box, and the sound effects and music's very sci-fi.
Yeah.
Love it. Babette's Feast I loved too. That one's like on HBO. I think you might even have a Criterion release. It's a touching one. It's funny. Beautifully shot. And then another Gabriel Axel movie that I have to talk about that I watched that Norgo did the score to is called Royal Deceit from 1994. Also known as Prince of Jutland. I think that's what it was on Tubi. I watched this on Tubi. And this one was impossible for me to rate. My Letterboxd review was, this needs to be programmed for Weird Wednesday ASAP. What a shit show.
Laird.
Watch it and love it as I do.
Okay.
It is. Listen to this cast. Gabriel Byrne.
Oh.
Helen Mirren.
Oh.
Christian Bale.
Oh.
Brian Cox.
Hey.
Kate Beckinsale.
Oh.
Andy Serkis.
Oh.
Ewan Brenner. Tom Wilkinson.
Oh.
It's all these, like, it sounds like, I was like, oh shit, this is going to be fun.
Yeah.
But it's a mess. It's an adaptation of this Danish legend of Prince Amleth. It's basically Hamlet.
Okay.
Yeah, Prince Amleth, which was the inspiration for Shakespeare's Hamlet. Gabriel Byrne, he wants to kill his brother, the king, so that he can take the crown. Bale plays the murdered king's son, and he goes mad within the first 15 minutes. He acts like a dog and a rooster the entire movie. The whole thing is so awkward. It's the best.
So he didn't yell at his brother and say, like, you're doing a great job.
Watch it.
Okay.
Watch it.
Or maybe he does. Okay.
And then the cast. Let's run through the cast real quick. And then we could start getting into our questions about this movie. The cast is small. I'm not going to spend too much time on it. First, we have John Price, who plays Steinmetz, the man with the power. Based on his credits, he was more of a comedic actor than a dramatic actor. He did win two Best Actor Awards at the Bodil Awards in 1962 and 66, which apparently that's like the Danish Film Awards equivalent to the Oscars.
Okay.
And he's great in this. Like, I think the whole cast is great.
Yeah.
He actually directed, wrote just as many films as he acted in, directing over 25 films, most of them TV movies. Then we have the brain surgeon, Max Holst, played by Preben Neergaard. He was also mainly a television actor. Most of his credits are associated with TV movies and series. His first acting gig was in 1943 when he was about 22. And he was in one of Carl Theodor Dreyer's movies, Day of Wrath. Mm. I have that queued up to watch because it looks interesting. And then lastly is Max Holst's fiance, Suzanne, played by Lotte Tarp. And I'm just pulling this. I pulled this straight from IMDb, but she worked both on stage and film. She appeared in 34 feature films and television productions. The main thing I wanted to pull was this. She was on Salvador Dali's short list of inspiring women.
Huh.
I didn't know he had like a list that came out.
Yeah.
I did notice, though, looking through her filmography, that she was in Arne Mattson's horror film called Moriana in 1969.
Oh, okay.
Or 65. We love Arne Mattson.
Yes, we do.
And she was also in a comedy directed by Michael Winner called The Jokers, starring Oliver Reed.
Okay.
So it looked like she had a, you know, a named role, a big role.
I mean, I'll watch it. Anything with Oliver Reed and it's directed by Michael Winner? Bring it.
Let's do it. Yeah, that's all I got for cast and crew.
All right, we'll be asking some questions about this film right after this promo from our network.
You're listening to the Prescribed Films Podcast Network, home to hundreds of hours of free podcast entertainment. The shows on this network all have a common goal, providing you with the best discussions about movies and other forms of entertainment media. The PFPN hopes to fill your earholes with audio joy. Visit our website with links to all the other amazing shows at www.thepfpn.com. Thanks for listening.
Okay, Erica.
Yeah.
So we have questions, a lot of hypothetical. What would you do in this situation? Would you, you know, should we just jump into those right away? Do you want to talk about the film a little bit?
Let's talk about the film a little bit first, and then we'll get into some questions.
Okay.
There's a couple moments in it where every now and then when, you know, when it's your pick for a movie, there'll be a certain like little thing where I'm like, that's why Lance picked this movie. And while this movie is great and it does ask a lot of big questions, and yes, it works good for during South By because it's, you know, not as much like side homework kind of thing.
Right.
The nurse at the hospital riding the Segway.
Yes.
I was like, this is why Lance picked this movie, because that's a full on Lynch moment right there.
Yes. Well, yeah. I, when that first popped up.
Yeah.
I was like, wait a minute, what year is this? It's 1969. Mm-hmm. It's very futuristic.
Yes.
You know, not just with how they frame the hospital, but she's riding around like she's in downtown Austin. I'm like, but yeah, I love that. That did jump out.
Yeah. But because they don't like acknowledge it at all. It's just part of this world. It's just happening in the background. Like, oh yeah, this nurse is just, you know, going to her next, you know, thing she's got to do on her little segue in the hospital. I was like, yeah, Lance.
Star Wars. Yeah. That's what I love about this movie too, is it's timeless. Like you can't tell, is it the future? Is it now?
Yeah.
And those little type of quirks and the architecture that they that's presented, it looks great.
Yes.
But yeah, that's one thing I do love about this movie. It's one of those rare movies where as soon as I started watching it, I was just like, it had my full attention. I don't think I ever looked at my phone. I put the phone down and just watch it. And few movies do that when you're at home alone.
Yeah.
Watching stuff on YouTube, you know, it's, and this one definitely does it. I didn't want, if there's any type of interruption, I would rewind it and make sure I didn't miss anything, because it does feel like a great mystery is unraveling where there are hidden clues throughout. And there may not be, but
I think it, like, at a certain point when Steinmetz started creating the multiple Maxes, I'm going to call it multiple Maxes.
I like it.
I, you know, because I at first I was kind of frustrated and I was like, am I being nitpicky? Because in the beginning he had said that a mouse disappears after, was it 3 days or 3 hours or something?
Yeah, like I think he said a few hours or something.
And so I was like, okay, well, based on like the amount of time and brain power it took him to create an inorganic object like a box of cigars, I imagine it takes exponentially more time to create a full human being. And then maintaining, I don't know if there's some sort of like subconscious part of your brain that needs to keep that thing alive, like the mouse or the multiple maxes or whatever it may be. So then I started thinking like, wait, it's a mouse only lasts like a few hours. How is he having Max like give this lecture, get married, like a brain surgery isn't going to take like, oh, you know, in and out in 30 minutes, like,
right.
You know, you can order a Domino's pizza and we'll be done with it kind of thing. So is that still a thing, by the way? Or is that just in like back in the Noid days, it was 30 minutes or less?
I mean, I don't know.
Okay.
I
sorry.
I feel like we ordered Domino's, I guess within the last couple of months, it was really quick, but I never remember seeing anything like 30 minutes, your pizza's free or anything like that.
Okay. So I started getting nitpicky about it. And I was like, wait a minute, this isn't lining up. But then I was like, well, no, that's meant to add to our confusion as well, because Max is trying to figure out what's happening before other Max, I guess doppelganger Max, shaves his beard. We can't distinguish between them. So we think like, oh yeah, he's giving this lecture, but then it turns out it's, and so it just adds to that layer of confusion. So we're kind of along the ride with real Max and trying to figure out, like, wait, who's real? What's happening?
Yeah.
Yeah, I actually do kind of like Doppelganger Max more.
It seems like everybody does, which is sad.
His girlfriend does. So.
Yeah, I think, yeah, that's a good point. And I think that is the whole, again, I think this is a science fiction movie through and through, but I think that is the horror element of the movie, because yeah. there's no gore, there's no ghosts, there's no murders, there's right. no jump scares, but it's the thought that in your head, like, what would happen if everyone you know doesn't believe that you're you, you know, that you're an imposter of who you truly are, you know? And right. it's a very thought provoking thing. Like, the first moment of horror, I feel like, in this movie is when Holtz quickly sees himself in the operating room. He walks in and, you know, there's like an operating room, like bright light that flashes, and he could see himself in his scrubs and stuff.
Yeah.
And he closes his eyes, he opens it, and it's just a pile of clothes. And he's like, what the hell was that? You know? And that's the first, like, kind of like, it really opens the door. Like, holy mm-hmm. shit, this is scary to think about. Like, yeah. where is this going to go? But yeah, and then of course there's the sci-fi element, what the human brain's capable of, the center, what Steinman says is the center of powers. This is, again, subtitled, but the center of powers that we absolutely know nothing about that he's trying to unlock. Mm-hmm. As humans, we've lived through the age of technology, but now we are entering the age of the soul. I love the multiple Max Holtz that are created. Like you said, I guess they only last, I think it's a matter of hours.
Yeah. And that's the good thing about it too, is that movies like this don't treat the audience like they're stupid. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't spoon feed everything to you. So you don't get like a shot of Steinmetz actually creating another Max and then explaining like, oh, well, they only last for this long, so I have to create multiple ones. Like, you have to see like the chaos that's happening with these being created. And this one, you know, is walking around the corner after sleeping with the girlfriend yeah. and disappearing after the lecture and all of these things. And so you're piecing all of this together. And I appreciate that about a movie like this.
Yeah, I do too. And that's why it's surprising to me that Jens Ravin didn't do more sci-fis and stuff. Like, I don't know, like, maybe he's just like, I can't top this. I got into Cannes. Yeah. I mean,
maybe it's a matter of like, I've got this really great story. I've got this great cinematographer behind me. I've got this. And so maybe it's just like, yeah, I peaked. I'm good. You know, yeah. I'm done.
Yeah, it could have been. I mean, and the cinematography, I mean, the camera work, like we've already said numerous times, it's so focused, so intentional. I just can't keep my eyes off it. Like very like Playtime, Jacques Tati, like everything looks like a painting, like a photograph that you can hang up on your wall.
It complements the story and the genre very well, because it's very like stark and clinical, mm-hmm. but I don't mean to say that, that it's not beautiful at the same time. It feel like everything is so fucking clean in this.
Yeah. There's this one scene of Holtz. He's in the hospital and he takes the elevator down mm-hmm. and then he's walking through the hospital and the camera's just following him, like, you know, behind cool architectural walls and openings and like breeze blocks, like just really, really this long tracking shots yeah. that when I dove into Theodore Carl Dreyer's filmography, like I could see, you can totally see, you know, he's like emulating a lot of his mentors and stuff mm-hmm. With the camera work and where to follow these actors. There's one genius shot though that I have to point out where Holtz is running. His fiance is getting married to the doppelganger.
Yeah.
And as they're married, they're walking away from like the altar or whatever, like down the aisle, and the church doors are open and you could see Max Holtz just running as fast as he can, like straight towards the camera and to the church.
Yeah.
And he's apprehended. It's just this great shot where I'm like,
it's beautiful. Amazing. Yeah. And I thought there was going to be like a Graduate moment or Abe Simpson missing movie a moment. Yeah, that shot is fantastic. That point you're like, wow, all is really lost for him. Like, his fiance just married his fucking doppelganger, he's under arrest, and imagine trying to explain this scenario to the cops. And like,
yeah, because he just came from work where they're like, Max Holtz is getting married. Like, yeah, and they don't like, believe he, you? Like everybody, yeah. like he's dissolved. He's become one of these doppelgangers, yeah. but he's living forever. Like he's, yeah, it's just this, I don't know. There's a lot of angles to look at. There's a lot of questions to ask.
Yeah. I feel like, you know, one of the things I was like, is there anything like he could have done to prove he's, you know, OG Max? Like, I mean, would he'd physically have to kidnap one of these doppelgangers and go to his like doctor friend and be like, we're going to sit in this room together and yeah. you're going to see this guy disappear. And that proves to you, I'm the real one. But even then it's like,
he would have to kill Steinmetz.
Yes.
And then he would be the only one left.
Right. Which, like, I mean, ultimate spoiler, I hope people have watched this already, but you know, spoiler, he doesn't kill him himself.
He doesn't. So I do love, we'll just jump into the yeah. ending. Yeah. He doesn't. So Steinmetz obviously has been creating these doppelgangers of Max Holtz, who's carrying on his work as a brain surgeon. He's marrying his fiance, but he keeps continuously creating these multiple Holtz, prepping them to do the surgery. Essentially yeah. They're capable at this point. So he creates a whole crew of nurses and Max Holtz to do the brain surgery. And at the very end, Max Holtz has a gun. He's getting ready to kill him.
Yeah.
But the doppelganger Max Holtz, they fail at the surgery and Steinmetz dies and all the doppelgangers, the whole, you know, nurses, surgeons, they all just disappear and become a pile of clothes.
Yeah.
And that ending fucking rules.
Yes. I was like, oh, fuck. Because again, getting back to like, they're not, you know, this movie doesn't spoon feed you anything. So like, we have no way of knowing that all these people who are assisting are also, you know, just people that he's created.
Yeah.
Because his power, like at the beginning, he says like, I want this brain surgery because my power to do this thing is limited and I need it to be unlimited. So it would seem like to create just one person would require a lot of energy. And then to create multiple people that would stay existing, I guess, for multiple hours in order to perform this surgery would be even more. And then my brain was like, well, wait, if he's like unconscious or even sleeping, like, right. Does that affect his ability to keep these people in existence? And so does the fact that like he was put under sedation, does that have anything to do with
the failed
surgery? Or was it like Max said at the beginning, he's like, the surgery is too risky. I would never do it. And,
right.
And even though Steinmetz was willing to undergo it, he's like, I'm willing to take the risk because that's how much he wanted to play God. And ultimately, yeah, he dies and all the people disappear. It's just all their clothes are there. And OG Max is there. And like with his gun, he was like, well, shit, problem solved.
Yeah. I kind of wish it ended there because then he goes and he shaves.
Yeah.
To become, you know, what his wife, to become his wife's husband at that point. You know, he's happy. They were planning to get married. I guess he's happy at this point. But the ending is a little silly where he pulls a cigar out of and the guy's like, his coworker's there, his peer. He's like, where did you get that cigar? He's all, oh, you wouldn't believe it if I told you. Yeah. How could anyone? And that was the end. And
yeah.
I'm like, that's kind of a weekend. But before that, I loved it all.
Yeah. I think it could have ended with him shaving just so like, you know, like, okay, he's going to go and step in to this role. But like everything yeah. after that, like the train like
credits
station,
while he's shaving. Over
yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So yeah, I would have cool. liked that, but you know, again, it's still a great movie. I didn't make it, so I'm not going to be like, excuse me, Mr. Raven, can you go back and change your ending?
Well, it's based on a novel too. Mm. And from what I had read, that is exactly how the book ends.
Oh, okay.
So I think he wrapped it up and I think he stayed true to a lot of the written word. So yeah, let's ask some of these deep questions.
Yeah.
So the first one is one that you posted on Instagram.
Yeah.
Let's ask it. What would you do if you had a doppelganger? What would you do with it?
Yeah. So the two options I posted on Instagram were, would you kill it or would you keep it? And a few people replied and been like, you know, we're like, you didn't put fuck it as one of the options. And yeah. I was like, well, see the next question.
Yeah.
End results of that, about 25% of people said they would kill it. Smart people like myself, like John Laird, shout out, said they would kill their doppelganger. other people, 75% said they would keep it. Now, of that, about half of those people said they would use their doppelganger. That was the follow-up question. Like, what are you going to do with your doppelganger if you're keeping it? About half the people said they would use it to like ease their workload or send that doppelganger to work, you know, for them, which makes sense. But the other half of you fucking degenerates, said that you would fuck it, including you.
That was a joke. Cause I mean, I did ask the question to Sarah as well. And she said the same thing. She's like, not fuck it. She said, I would, I'm fucking swamped at work. I would need somebody to help.
Yeah.
But she, you know, said, you're already a doppelganger. Like, what do? You're a twin. And I was like, well, I'm not going to fuck Cody. But no, I jokingly said, fuck it.
Yeah. I mean, you did like kind of like follow that up with a joke part of it. But still, you got lumped in with everyone else who said that, including.
We're going to call him out.
Yeah. So I'm not going to call everyone out, but I am going to call Klon out because he voluntarily sent a audio message to us explaining his choice. I played it and it's hilarious. And for whatever reason, Instagram won't let me play it again for y'all to share. So I'm sorry. But loud and proud, Kwan's like, I'd totally fuck do some butt stuff with with my doppelganger. And I'm like, all right, y'all. I mean, I would kill it. Like I'm not saying I would do that because, well, there can only be one me. I'm just getting ahead of the game because if I'm worried about my doppelganger killing me, then it's going to have that thought about me. And so I'm like, okay, then no, can't have that. If I were to keep it, I would probably be like, okay, I'm going to have, there has to be some way to like.
Keep him reined in. Like not like, I feel like he couldn't venture out into the world or something. Like I would need him to do, I don't know, like paint the house or something. Like as soon as like a doppelganger goes out into the world, it's, who knows what can happen.
Right.
You could rob a bank.
Yeah.
You know,
it's like you can, I work from home. I'm like, you can stay here and you can do my job and sit through all my dumb meetings about, you know, fucking click to open rates or whatever.
Yeah. That's when you start thinking like how much of is this doppelganger have all of your thoughts and memories and your behaviors and reactions? Like, is it exactly like you? Will it, like, if you do have it work for you at your day job, will it just come home and tell you what you did? Like it seems like it's just a lot of work to maintain.
And it feels like, you know, kind of getting back to that movie you were talking about with AI and those robots and them starting to develop their own feelings. Like a doppelganger in a way kind of feels like another kind of AI where it's a replication of something real.
Right.
But, and so to me, that just like all sounds like it's going to end in disaster.
Right.
I just... You know, it's the it's organic Skynet. You know, it's just like, this is all going to go terribly wrong. And I don't want a fucking doppelganger around as much fun as that would be to do, you know, butt stuff with Klon. Like, I just, you know, I can't.
Would you want to fuck yourself? Well, I would rather, you know, just, I would want to watch me, my doppelganger, fuck somebody else just to like, be like, yeah, I could do that differently. You know, get, take notes. And I don't know. Like, yeah, I need to shave my butt. I don't know. I've never seen that angle. Like, I don't know. Like, yeah. A lot of people saying, like Sarah said, that she would have it help at the day job.
Yeah.
But then, yeah, once they start doing your work, they have like a one up if they learn something that you don't know. And it's.
Yeah. Do you have a shared consciousness
right,
with them?
That's so what I'm wondering.
What if your doppelganger, you know, gets hit by a car or something and then you have to go back to work and then your boss is like, hey, that project I told you to work on. And you're like, what is that? So,
or you show up and they're all, hey, I thought you were dead.
That too. That's a problem with me thinking, like my initial thought was, well, if I kept it, then I would want, I'll send them out to go like fucking rob a bank or something. But then I was like, well, wait, then like, my job would think I'm in jail for robbery. So would I then like come be like, oh no, hi, it's me. And whoever this person is, they're impersonating me, but secretly I take the money. Of course, you know?
Yeah. See that I started thinking that too, like, oh, I could go assassinate some people that I fucking hate, you know, or like, you know, high profile people, but that would
allegedly.
Be me. Allegedly, of course.
Yeah.
But then I thought, well, Steinmetz. So another question is, if you had this power that Steinmetz had, would you? Because you it doesn't have to be a doppelganger. You can will any person. You can will, you know, your neighbor and have them carry out robberies. You can start thinking about like pets that you've lost and loved and miss. You can start thinking about deceased family members and friends. Like, it could get really dark in a mess.
Yeah. This kind of brings me back to The Sweet Sound of Death, where, you know, you had asked about like, what about this afterlife deal? Would you want to do? And I'm like, no, I need a finite end. And I apply that across the board. Like,
even if you had a power to bring back the dead.
Yes. I love and miss my cat Dee Dee. That was such a gut punch when I lost her.
Yeah.
But every living thing has its end, and that's it. Except Franco Nero. He's never going to die. So, but I can't, like, I wouldn't want to will that. I mean, if I can create anything just with my mind, it's fucking money. Like, I'm sorry. Like, people say money doesn't buy happiness. Fuck you. You have money. Yeah,
that's true.
If you think that's true. So like, I would, yeah. If I had that power, fuck money. That's it. Exactly. That's all I would do, is just make money out of it.
Yeah. I mean, I think, like you said, Franco Nero, like, you'd want to fuck Franco Nero. You can create Franco Nero, young Franco Nero, and you could fuck him, and then maybe just kill him. Like, I feel like, because I read Adam, who watched this movie, and he said, like, why do people want to create more humans? People are talking about creating more humans. I would never want to do that. I'd want to create vinyl or some out of print Blu-rays or something. Shout out, Adam.
You know what's up. No more people.
Yeah, which is great. But I think if you had the power, you get bored of like this physical, like, you would want, I don't know. I feel like if I started off with the mindset of, I will never create a living being.
Yeah.
I just want money. I want, you know, I want the best computer. I want, you know, whatever. I want a badass, you know, Fender Strat from like, you know, the 70s. But I'd be like, well, what can I do? Like, what happens if I create a living being? And I feel like a lot of people would think that. Like, I don't know. With Steinmetz's situation, I took a step back and I was like, well, this is a lonely man who obviously is very full of himself. Like, he says all this stuff, like, I'm full of imagination. You know, he's very conceited. He knows he has this power.
Well, he has a God complex, and that's a huge part of this. Like, I mean,
I think he does want to create, cause he's a lonely man. I think he does want to create like an army of sex dolls. Like, he wants these people, and he does, obviously he wants to control and take over like people's lives and stuff, and just be like the puppet master.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a tough question. Like, if you had this power, what would you do with it? Because obviously we're going to be entering the age of the soul pretty soon. It's going to happen. Steinmetz said it.
I feel like you have to have one in order to be part of that age, so I'm good.
Okay, here's another question now. Mm. If you were Holtz, if you were the brain surgeon and a Steinmetz approached you, would you do the surgery?
No, I'd actually kill Steinmetz. I'd be like, you know, yo, someone like that should not be like your fucking God complex. No, like someone who can do something like that. Okay, here's what I would do. Here's why I'm a shitty person. I would tell him, yes, I will do the surgery for X amount of money that you need to produce.
Right, monetize off of it.
Yeah, right now in front of me, produce this money for me. And then he produces the money and then I kill him and I take the money.
So yeah, that's where I was a little unsure of in the movie. It's just living things that can only last a few hours, right? Mm-hmm. Like the cigars and everything that was maintained forever.
Yeah, that's my impression because he had that cigar at the very end, and so I was like, okay, inorganic stuff stays.
Right,
that makes sense. Yeah. But the organic stuff, I can see why that would have, you know, a expiration date.
Right. Yeah, if I was approached, I would treat it like, okay, I would do it, knowing that I would, if anything gets out of hand, I'd just kill this man, right? If it was a successful surgery and he can create people, well, I guess those people would then be out in the world.
Yes.
But I'd be like, I get VIP, I priority access. Like, this is, all my wishes come true. I don't know. It's Yeah, no, I there's a lot of I would do this, but then, you know, I'll think about it tonight and be like, fuck no. Like,
yeah.
All these situations, they keep snowballing. It's all a bad idea.
Yeah, I don't think you should humor somebody who has a God complex, who thinks like it's, you know, they can create life and, you know, out of nothing. It's just...
Ugh. I would want him to create Peter Cushing as Frankenstein so he can create life.
Aw.
I miss Peter Cushing. That's who I'd fuck old Peter Cushing. I'm just kidding. Oh, God. There it is, guys. Okay, that's...
All right, and that's that movie. Okay.
All right, double feature picks. this movie, like we already said, it's very thought-provoking. I love it. I love watching it. I'll watch it again for sure. I'd love for it to get some sort of release with extra features so we can learn more about the cast and crew, because there's not a lot out there.
Yeah.
Do you love it?
I do.
Good.
I think people should watch it. It's on YouTube. Should get a release, I hope.
Nurses riding around in scooters.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't get any better than that.
That's great.
Okay, let's do double feature pick.
Let's.
What is yours?
So, I mean, I kind of talked about, the God complex, a few times already. So I think almost any iteration of Frankenstein you could pair with a movie like this. But ultimately, I went with a doppelganger movie. And this is one that I think I watched for either Junesploitation or Horror Gives Back in a previous year, called The Darker Side of Terror from 1979. It's the Robert Forster clone movie where he's a scientist and he gets involved in an experiment to create a doppelganger. And there's two Robert Forsters, and even one Robert Forster is great, but then you get double. It's also got Adrian Barbeau and Grumpy Ray Milan. So it's not great. It is entertaining though. And I just think it would be a fun, if you're going to do a double feature, it almost feels like it should be a double doppelganger feature.
Yeah.
So that's the direction I went.
Yeah. I leaned into that too. I'm going more into the sci-fi than the horror genre too. And I'm going with Moon from 2009, directed by Duncan Jones.
Oh, okay.
David Bowie's son. It stars Sam Rockwell as Sam Bell. I think everybody should have seen this, but if not, watch it. So Sam Bell, he's nearing a 3-year-long contract with Lunar Industries, mining Earth's primary source of energy on the dark side of the moon. And he can't wait to return to Earth to his wife and daughter. He misses them dearly. And on one of his last little mining expeditions, he has this accident and he's rescued by a clone of himself, a doppelganger. And the clone, they both realize that Lunar Industries is, I guess, unethically using clones to, to carry out these mining expeditions to save costs on training, transporting new astronauts. So they kind of work together, the clones, while also believing that the other is a fake to try and get home. It's one of my favorite sci-fis. I love it.
Yeah.
And it holds a special place in my heart because my twin brother and I, we did a gallery show in 2015. It was called There Are Two of Me. That was the name of the show. So it was all kind of, it was themed around doppelgangers and stuff. And we asked the museum if they could play music on repeat.
Uh-huh.
Or I did. I asked the museum if they could play music on repeat during the shows while it was running for a couple of months. And they're like, yeah. And I picked the Moon soundtrack by Clint Mansell. It's the greatest. But Moon. It's it's getting mixed up with the doppelgangers that are on screen. Kind of you know, The Man Who Thought Life.
I think that brings up, another question we didn't really talk about is the idea of there's this other layer of horror where it's once you realize that there is a doppelganger,
mm-hmm.
then, then there's that horror of well, wait, what if I'm the doppelganger? What if I'm the clone? Who is the original? How do I even know if I really exist? Because if all my memories this doppelganger has, what if it's me?
Yeah, that's what's really there's so many unknowns, but my theory is that these doppelgangers share all your experiences. They're a true doppelganger through and through.
Right.
And that's, I think Moon, Duncan Jones's Moon, really hits on that way more than The Man Who Thought Life, because Max Holtz knows he's the original. But that's another thinker. Yeah, so that's it. The Man Who Thought Life, good double feature picks.
Nice.
What's your next pick, Erica?
So really quick before getting into next pick, just wanted a couple of shout out announcements things. I went back on Ryan's channel on YouTube, Disconnected, to talk about some dick destruction movies. So, celebrating Women's History Month, March. So
I hope this segues into a dick destroyer.
It does not. Oh, okay. But I do have a, no, I don't have a segue for that. So no. and then one other announcement, folks probably saw the latest, Vinegar Syndrome announcements that are for the halfway to Black Friday sale. One of those is a Spanish horror box set. They haven't announced special features for any of those yet, but I have it on good authority that somebody who likes watching kids die in movies has an essay in there. So yeah, look out for that. All right. And then getting into next pick, Lance, next month.
It is April. Yes. April showers of blood.
Yes.
We're doing it again.
Yes. So that means that we choose a movie with blood in the title, or sangre, whatever it may be. And so my pick for April Showers of Blood this year is a movie called Pure Blood from 1982. It is a Colombian film directed by Luis Ospina, and it's about a dying old man who suffers from a rare disease for which the only treatment is transfusions of blood from young boys. The old man's son blackmails a few of the company employees to get the blood for his father by any means necessary. So it's not a traditional vampire film. It's more of like a social commentary vampirism film. But it's really good. I watched this for the first time last year. As of this recording, it has 820 views on Letterboxd. It has one of my favorite posters of all time on it.
Yeah, I just pulled that up. That can go with like the Lynette, the way it's, you know, this kind of
the grainy, like black and white in the background. Yeah, it's awesome.
Illustrations. Really.
This one is streaming on a new place for us. This one is actually on Vimeo. So I will post a link to that in show notes. I'll also put that on Twitter when it gets, you know, closer to when we're going to be covering the film. But yeah, just go in show notes for this episode. You'll see a link to Vimeo for the film. It does have subtitles, so don't need to do anything special for that. So yeah, April Showers of Blood kicks off with Pure Blood, 1982. If you're not already, you can follow this podcast on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, all at Unsung Horrors. You can follow me on Letterboxd, Instagram, and Twitter at Hex Massacre.
I'm El Shibe on Instagram and Letterboxd.
All right, thanks everyone for listening, and we'll see you back for April Showers of Blood.
Yes, bye.
Bye.
Clown status. Hey, it's Death by Video.
I'm Phil.
I'm Kit.
And I'm Graham, saying welcome to our podcast full of merry movie mayhem.
Ever wonder what an Irish kung fu movie would look like?
It's called Fatal Deviation, and we covered it.
Ever wonder what a movie about a thousand cats would look like?
It's called Night of a Thousand Cats, and we covered it.
And it stars Hugo Stiglitz. Listen to Death by Video to hear us discuss and dissect some of the weirdest, wildest, and wackiest films ever made. All this and more on Death by Video! Woo!